Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, quarterly market update episode for this first quarter of 2018. I am here with our resident expert, economist, and wealth advisor, Paul Sloat, founder of Green Drake Advisors based in Wayne, Pennsylvania. On today's quarterly market update episode, which we will be doing four times this year, Paul fills us in on the economic forces at work in the national and global economy and what those forces might be expected to do to the local real estate investment markets in the short and the long term. Some of the big changes we've seen recently are the new tax code, along with some risks around the world, which could translate into unexpected cost overruns on construction projects. Let's get right to it, shall we? Welcome back to the show, Mr. Paul Sloat. How are you doing this fine January afternoon?
I'm doing well. How are you, Dan?
Doing fantastic. We're finally getting out of for what in our business is a little bit of a slow season coming through the holidays. The phones are ringing off the hook, you know, middle of January, and we expect our activity and business volume to continue to climb, certainly through the middle to the end of the summer, that's for sure.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. We've now got a Trump economy going versus what would have been a Clinton economy. And we'll talk about that in a little bit for our listeners.
All right. And for the listeners' sake, we are recording January 18th, 2018, and we will do this episode going forward once per quarter. So I'm going to go ahead and turn the floor over to you, Paul, and let you give us the quarterly market update.
Okay. So we're going to talk about a couple of things, sort of big picture today, and how it's going to impact the real estate markets. And I think the first thing for listeners to really understand is that a Trump economy is growing at a much faster clip than a Clinton economy would have grown. So if you look at the economic data, since President Trump came into office, the U.S. economy has grown at 3% or better each quarter last year. We expect this growth to continue and potentially accelerate over the next 1 to 2 years. Now, we point this out because this has significant implications for interest rates, inflation, what's going to go on outside of just the U.S., and also what's going to go on with the way real estate properties have been evaluated and valued in the marketplace. And so we'll talk a little bit about each of these. But the most important thing to think about is that the economy is growing at a faster rate fundamentally, and it is well supported by what's going on. And this is even before investment has begun to accelerate, which we expect to occur over the next 1 to 2 years. And over the next couple of years, what we see happening is that real capital investment will happen for two reasons. Number one, wage growth is picking up, and the only way to offset the squeeze on wages is by increasing investment to improve productivity. So we think that that's one reason that investment is going to pick up. The other reason we think investment is going to pick up is because of what's going to go on with trade and China. China, for those who are unexperienced with how they run their economic policy, has basically run a mercantilist economic policy. And by this, we mean their goal is to import raw materials such as iron ore or natural gas and export finished goods to the rest of the world. And what they have done industry by industry is effectively start by producing the finished good and buying components from the rest of the world, and ultimately backward integrate into the manufacture of all those components. And so we'll give you a real simple one that's in the press today, and then we'll give you some other examples as well. So, for example, Huawei, who is one of the largest Chinese makers of telecom equipment, currently buys most of its semiconductors and other parts from outside of China and puts them in its equipment and then sells the equipment. China, a couple of years ago, decided this was not good, and so it decided it was going to build a domestic semiconductor manufacturing business. And to the tune of approximately $150 billion, the Chinese government is subsidizing the construction of semiconductor fabs, as well as all the assorted infrastructure that goes on, such as the companies that manufacture the wafers that go into semiconductor fabs, as well as the semiconductor equipment manufacturers. And to ensure that Chinese companies win in China, what the Chinese government has done is when Chinese companies have competed with outside companies is effectively banned outside companies. And we'll give you a specific example of something that occurred in the last couple of months. A company called Vico Instruments, they make something called MOCVD equipment. It's basically chemical vapor deposition that's used in the manufacture of things like LED plates for manufacturing TVs or LEDs that go into lighting or all sorts of other things. Well, China created a company to compete with Vico. And what that company did was use some technology from a European company that violated the U.S. company's patents. The U.S. company won patent contests in the U.S. and Europe against the company using this European technology. However, in China, the Chinese courts found that the patents of the U.S. company violated the patents of the Chinese company and banned the U.S. company from selling its equipment in China. Now, this is a pattern that has been repeated over and over again. And so when China decides it wants to own an industry, it basically bans foreign goods. It's done this throughout the chemical industry, where in manufacture of, let's say, polyester cloth for clothes, China first became a leader in manufacturing the clothes, then it backward integrated into manufacturing the cloth, then it backward integrated into the basic components that went into the cloth, such as polyester staple, which is the basic chemical. And then what it did is it backward integrated into all the dyes and other chemicals that were used to take the polyester staple and turn it into actual fabric. And in doing so, it put in place significant tariffs on chemical manufacturers in the U.S. and Europe, who basically were the low-cost producers globally, in order to ensure that its companies would be profitable. And it would harm the U.S. and European companies who had been exporting goods to China. So we think we need to pay attention to this, because the U.S. and Europe are finally starting to retaliate against China for its policies of freezing out their goods industry by industry. And in fact, China is now going after another industry. It's called the optical equipment. That means everything that goes into building a telecom network, whether it's the fiber optic cable made by domestic U.S. companies like Corning, or whether it's the actual equipment made by U.S. and European companies that send the light waves along that fiber optic cable. China has decided it wants all of it to be made in China. And in fact, in the fall, instituted a five-year plan to have 100% domestic Chinese content by 2021. And not only that, to have three of the top 10 global telecom equipment companies by 2019 and have one of the top three by 2021, and also to have a 30% global share. Now, we point out that China has no technology here, and that all the patents are owned by U.S. and European companies. So the only, and Japanese companies as well. So the only way that China could do this is by effectively borrowing or stealing the technology from foreign companies. And I think that what's happening now is the rest of the world is waking up to this. Now, this is going to be very important because it's going to have a big impact on the way trade flows, and it's ultimately going to have a big impact on inflation. One of the reasons inflation has been so low has been because China has flooded the world with its goods, and the U.S. and Europe and other developed countries have said, okay, we'll take these as long as you take our goods. But what has become clear is that China is less willing to take other countries' goods, and as a result, you'll see their goods being shut out of other markets. Now, it'll start with steel, but I believe it'll go to technology products and products in numerous areas. And this will be inflationary because the big thing that's kept prices down over the last decade has been China's ability to export goods to the rest of the world at effectively zero profit while making all its profit in China by cutting out foreign goods. Now, if inflation goes up, that is going to start impacting a number of things. It's going to impact labor costs for real estate. It's going to impact specifically interest rates, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And it's also going to impact how real estate properties are valued, okay? So while this trade dispute may seem not to impact the real estate industry, over the intermediate term, it can have significant impacts for a variety of reasons. And so the simplest one is to look at steel used in the construction of major buildings. So if Chinese steel and foreign steel is cut out of the market because it's being dumped here in the U.S., well, what will happen is the price of steel will go up. And the price of steel has already gone up, and it will go up more, and that will impact what it costs to build the building and make it harder to make the economics work given current rents. So that's just one example. The second thing that will happen is in other areas whereby we have, you know, fairly tight capacity and it's been supplied by overseas goods to plug the gap and prevent prices from accelerating upwards, some of that extra material isn't going to be there. So, for example, fiberglass, which is used in insulation, has the potential to be shut out from China. If that's shut out, you've got basically U.S. and European capacity, and while there's a little extra European capacity, U.S. capacity is fairly full, and prices are going to go up for the insulation you use in any house. And they have been going up already, and that will accelerate. So we think that you have to pay real careful attention because the cost of all the goods that are bought for any type of construction or remodeling are going to go up. And that kind of thing needs to start being built into how you look at the economics of your property. The other thing that will happen is, assuming inflation accelerates, which it appears it will, and economic growth accelerates, which it has done already and will probably accelerate more, is that interest rates will go up. Now, this will be restrained somewhat because Japanese and European interest rates are extremely low, and there's a very high difference between U.S. and European interest rates right now, especially on the long end at the 10-year where most things are financed using 10-year financing. However, and we use this however, interest rates are probably headed up, and it's pretty easy to believe that the 10-year Treasury, which has gone from 2.5% to 2.6%, will reach 3% this year. And if we were to actually look at correlations of nominal GDP growth, in other words, how fast the economy is growing in nominal dollars, then 10-year interest rates today should really be 3.5% or 4%. So in other words, they're over a percent below where they should be given past correlations on interest rates and inflation. So we think this is something that has to be watched pretty carefully in the real estate area. And the other reason for that is if we look at the cap rates that have been put on property transactions. So if we look at Q3, cap rates were pretty low. And what you basically had was a 2.6% spread between 10-year Treasury rates and cap rates in the third quarter. These cap rates normally are 3 to 3.5% above the 10-year Treasury. So if cap rates were around 5.1, 5.2 in the third quarter and been fluctuating between 5.1 and 5.5 on average, now there are certain classes where it's below 5%, and Treasuries go from 2.5% where they were at the end of last year to 3% this year, and the spread on Treasuries goes to 3 or 3.5%, all of a sudden cap rates go from the 5 to 5.5% range to the 6 to 6.5% range. And while that doesn't sound like a huge change, it is a big change because it means that the multiple on the cash flow could drop 20% on a property when you go to sell it. So you have to think about how this might impact the value on your property. That's the trade issue. The other issue that's starting to percolate, and we've been writing about this for a few years, is that the dollar has been about 20 to 25% overvalued versus currencies in the rest of the world. And what happened last year was the dollar fell about 8% on a trade-weighted basis, but most of that was against the European euro. And the reason it was mostly against the European euro and the European currencies is because the euro rose against the dollar, and the other European countries, such as Sweden or Czechoslovakia, saw their currencies rise in tandem with the European currency. And the European currency is still below fair value. But the currencies that didn't really appreciate against the dollar were the Asian currencies or the Latin American currencies. We think that as part of fixing this whole trade issue, which includes other countries besides China, by the way, that part of this will be adjusting the value of the U.S. dollar to an appropriate value against these currencies. And so that ultimately the U.S. dollar will depreciate against those currencies as well, because it's still probably 20 to 25% overvalued against the Asian currency. So there's a big adjustment still to come in Asia, and all of that dollar dropping will also fuel inflation, because goods prices will go up because buying the same good from other countries in the world will cost more. So anyway we look at it, all this is going to feed back into inflation, it's going to feed back into interest rates, and ultimately it's going to feed back into wages. So when you think about your businesses going forward, that is a major issue. Now, the other major issue comes to public market valuation. A lot of what goes on in private transactions is predicated on public market valuation. And it's relative to what's in the public market. Now, the issue with public market valuations is they are sort of in the 99th percentile of valuations on a historical perspective, and have set themselves up that if anything goes wrong, there could be a correction. Now, I would point out that this correction is probably more like something that we saw in 98 or 1987. And from a stock market perspective, where the stock market lost 15 or 20% over a short period of time, but then went on to new highs. We think that this is something that could easily happen here, where the market loses 10, 15, 20% of its value over a short period of time because of the valuations out there. There is no valuation support. And something goes wrong somewhere. Now, what this something could be anything from the U.S. dollar depreciating at a faster rate and people getting worried about that, and inflation heating up and people getting worried about that, or it could be a trade spat with China that begins to spiral out of control. And the market gets worried about that because a number of public companies have significant exposure to China. It could be something like a war in North Korea, because that's always possible. Or it could be, for example, Saudi Arabia, where the current prince has effectively attempted to push 100% of the former powers that be out of the limelight, that they get together and they attempt to retake control, and there is a power struggle in a place like Saudi Arabia. We don't know what it is, and we don't know what it will be, but we do know that the environment is very reminiscent of 1987, where the market had a melt-up at the same time that interest rates were going up, at the same time as inflation was accelerating, and eventually it corrected. Now, it was a very nasty correction, but people have to remember them. Despite the correction, the market finished up on the year, because what was going on in the market had little or nothing to do with what was going on in the economy. And so we have to remember that those are two separate, distinct things. So in this case, we think that the market might have a problem, but the economy just continues on its way. And so what we have to think about here in terms of the real estate area is, number one, what does it mean as interest rates are headed up? Number two, what does it mean as we plan projects if inflation is headed up and it's going to cost more over time to do all the stuff that we need to do when we buy a piece of property, whether it's raw or whether it's a piece of property that needs to be rehabbed? And lastly, we need to think about these things that could come along and put temporary hiccups into the marketplace, and that could impact us, like something blowing up in North Korea or something happening on trade that looks like it could start to have a real impact. And those are really the big picture things we are sort of focused on, at least in the first half of this year. And those are the big picture things we think you should focus on. We're not worried about U.S. growth. We think growth's going to be good this year. And we think growth's going to be good next year, as long as the Federal Reserve doesn't choke off the economy. And we don't think they will, for a variety of reasons we won't get into here, which could take another 20 or 25 minutes to discuss. But we think that you got good growth, but then you have all these other things going on that could impact interest rates, inflation, and or public sentiment. And that's my message for today. Next quarter, I'll go over the various classes of real estate and where we sit on each of those classes. Dan, you have any questions?
I do, Paul. I don't know if you had a chance or even the expertise or would look at the new tax structure and the tax code that came out to maybe provide
it kind of got mostly a pass. But here's the one area. There's a couple of places where there was not a pass, okay? The two places that were not a pass is you can no longer deduct home equity loans, okay, on your taxes. So that was eliminated, which means home equity, by the way, has been in decline and been declining like 7 or 8% per year since the recession and has never come back. And I think that this is going to encourage even less home equity because you can't deduct it, right? And will encourage, if people want to do stuff, for them to refinance their core mortgage, okay? So I think that that's one. So that's one thing that is affecting the individuals. It does not affect real estate investors. They were left exempt in the law in that as long as it's an LLC and it's an investment property, you get to deduct 100% of your interest, because the private homeowner can only deduct up to $750,000 of mortgage-related interest, as opposed to a private investor who owns a home who can deduct an unlimited amount of interest related to a mortgage. Okay? So those are the big things. And then there was some accelerated depreciation, which if you own a building, you'll be able to depreciate certain things over shorter periods of time, which should allow for accelerated cash flow for large investments. But those are the big pieces that I saw.
Sounds good, Paul. And then the other thing is, I don't have any hard data, but I do remember what was going on with prices when I was rehabbing properties and first got in like 2006 and 2007. I remember being at the Home Depot and seeing the price of copper going up and seeing the price of drywall going up, et cetera. Is this an inflationary period that I'm referencing here in memory, similar to what you think or what we're starting to see in the marketplace now for building materials?
Yeah, I think that that's exactly what we're starting to see because, for example, we are adding some capacity for MDF, right? You know, MDF, which is basically reconstituted wood, right? That's made from wood chips and other things. However, and this capacity, they started to build it about a year ago, and they started to add it and build it, and it'll start coming on late this year. But here's the issue. If you look at all the capacity that's coming on, that will be chewed up by a mere 200,000 increase in housing starts. And we're well on our way to increasing houses about 200,000 units from when they started to build this capacity to when it's going to come on. So all it's going to do is satisfy existing market demand for more product. So capacity utilization in the industry is not really going to fall down, which will mean that pricing is probably going to go up despite the capacity, which I think is going to be the surprise. And people have to remember, in many industries in the United States, we have not added capacity since the early 2000s to sort of this 05, 06, 07 period. So it's been a decade in many industries since capacity has been added. And if that's true, it means, especially given that we can produce a lot more goods for our own consumption versus importing them, that we could add a lot of capacity before it's going to start impacting capacity utilization. Does that answer the question, Dan?
It does. Do you have a current napkin calculation for the housing starts deficit that we might still be looking at?
Well, you're still a couple of, you know, a few hundred thousand short, because if I remember correctly, I think all housing starts are up around 1.1 million starts, if I remember correctly. And what we really need is about 1.4 million to 1.5 million starts, okay? So we're still a few hundred thousand short there. What we really need is we need those starts on the single-family side, not the multifamily rental side. So I still think there's a way to go, especially on the single-family side. There's a long way to go on the actual housing starts.
Got it. So the question to follow up with that is, and I'm playing ignorant here, when are those housing start reports gathered? So is there going to be like a backlog of information, let's say December 2018, where all of a sudden we look around and we say, oh, God, there's 1.7 million housing starts in the
country? No, we're not there, and I'll explain why. Okay. The reason why is that in order to build all this stuff, we need to permit the land. And the public builders, who are a major portion of this, are just starting to ramp up the number of communities under construction. And so it's going to take them a while, probably another 3 years would be my gut guess, to get us there. Right now, what's happened is private builders have become more aggressive as credits become available. But it's probably, if I were to look at this whole thing, it's going to take at least 2 years, probably 3 years, to get to normalized levels of single family construction. However, as in all things, normalized levels are probably not going to be enough on the single family side because of the millennials, right? So I think you're going to have to build more than normalized levels of houses to sort of balance the market, at least near term, and then you'll come back to sort of normalized levels. Does that make any sense, Dan?
It does. It answers the question, Paul.
Okay. Any other questions?
I think that about wraps us up for now. I have a ton of notes here. I'm sure some of the listeners do as well. I really appreciate you coming on and giving us an update here. One thing I might just ask you to look out for our next quarterly update would be any statistics that might be a harbinger on the horizon that could be problematic for any part of single family real estate. As an example of like a particular niche would be, I'm starting to hear some rumors and grumblings about days on market increasing for $500,000 and up houses. So I don't know if there's anything you'd be able to...
Well, I can give you a quick synopsis of what I know is the reality, okay? The reality is that what's needed are inexpensive starter homes. And so what you've got going on here is a disconnect between some of what some of the public builders are building and some of the demographics, okay? And what's happening is the baby boomers are selling houses, but they're not starter homes. And I'll give you an example of what's going on here in the Philadelphia area. Houses under $500,000 are moving very quickly. And in most of the better communities here on the main line, because housing's a little more expensive in Philly, but not as expensive nearly as New York, Washington, Boston, or any of the major metros, right? Houses up to about $800,000-$900,000 are moving relatively quickly. The issue is when you get north of $1 million, because there the supply-demand balance is the wrong way. The millennials are not ready to buy their move-up homes yet. That won't occur until like 2021, 2022, and the baby boomers are selling them. So you've got a mismatch, and that's why it's taken a while for those homes to sell. Now, we can think about that, and in lower price markets, those price points, of course, would move down, right? Does this make any sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. So in another second or third tier market price-wise, they might be right around $500,000, where we're talking about $700,000 to $800,000 probably in the Philadelphia market. Maybe we're talking about $900,000 to $1 million, maybe a little above $1 million in like a Chicago or a Boston, right?
Right, or New York or something like that, right? Because the housing is more expensive, okay? So it's relative to the market.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing you have to remember is I do think this change in the deductibility of state and local taxes is going to have a negative impact on the high end of the housing market, right?
What exactly were the deductions that are limited now?
Correct. So, you know, it's been estimated that this will have anywhere from a 5 to 10% negative impact on places like New York, San Francisco, you know, Boston at the high end, because prices will have to come down to make up for the loss of the mortgage interest deduction.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? Laws of economics, right? If I'm going to buy a home and I have a certain amount of, you know, cash flow, and effectively my cash flow got cut because I can't deduct 100% of my interest anymore, well, I got to buy a less expensive house, right?
Absolutely.
Right. So it's that simple. But I haven't heard rumblings of the single family market having problems yet. What I do understand is you are getting a real bifurcation between the entry level and then the move up housing.
Well, cool. Paul, do you want to share with the listeners a little bit about what you do, who you are, your company and contact info if they would like to get in touch with you?
Sure. I'll share that, and thank you, Dan, for the opportunity to share that. Our company is called Green Drake Advisors. We are a broad wealth management company. Not only do we do the investment management for our clients, but we also do all the financial planning, business succession planning, estate planning that they might need, as well as providing our insights on what we see going on in various industries and the economy, so they can use them as inputs into their business and business plans. In addition, we'll take a look at their strategic position in their businesses and offer what we see going on. So we actually operate as pretty much a full-service wealth management company that can actually provide insights into our clients' businesses. So that makes us a little bit different. You can find us on the web at www.greendrakeadvisors.com, or you can call our offices. It's 610-687-7766, and someone will get back to you. Thanks, Dan.
All right, great. Well, Paul, I appreciate you coming on the show. It's been a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to the next quarter of hopefully good news.
Thanks, Dan. Until next quarter, have a good one.
Thank you for listening to this episode, the Quarterly Market Update of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving an email notification the next time an REI Diamond Show episode is released? You can either sign up at www.reidiamonds.com or subscribe through one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Do you currently have a deal for sale? You
probably already have my email address. You could send it over. But if not, you can also send over directly to me using the contact me link at www.reidiamonds.com. That does go straight to my personal email. I am currently buying in Philadelphia, New Jersey, Delaware, Chicago, Atlanta, and Tampa Bay and Miami regions in Florida. You can also find deals I have for sale there, along with our full catalog of REI Diamonds episodes. Thank you again for being a loyal listener of the show. Dan Breslin here. Catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.